The military is also trying to make big changes in what fuel it uses. The Air Force and Navy have been testing their aircraft, everything from fighters to unmanned spy planes, on fuel made from vegetable oil or even animal fat. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren took a ride in the cockpit of an Air Force jet flying on biofuel.
Major Josh Fry has been piloting C-130s for a dozen years over Iraq and Afghanistan. On all his missions, the fuel came from one source, petroleum. But on this flight, half of the fuel comes from the seed of a plant called camelina. Fry relays data about how his engines are performing to Master Sergeant Jason Hale.
All right, you ready, Sergeant Hale?
Yes, sir.
Number one, 4260.
Hale's on board to verify that the biofuel works.
Got it, sir.
Good to go?
As we fly over West Texas, Fry takes a few minutes to talk.
I never would have known a difference, to be honest. It flies exactly the same. I never would have known a difference.
That's how all the Air Force test flights of biojet fuel have gone. Jeffrey Braun heads up the Air Force Alternative Fuels Program.
We wanted it to be boring, and it was boring.
So far, the Air Force has approved F-15 and F-16 fighters and C-17 transport planes to use 50% biofuel. The Navy plans to approve all its planes and surface ships to run on green energy by the end of the fall. Braun says when President Bush called on the country to kick its addiction to oil several years ago, the military first focused on turning coal into liquid fuel.
When we first started, nobody had any clue that the biofuels were so close behind. We thought it was going to be another 10 years before we start looking at biofuels, but it turned out it was about 2 years.
High-tech chemical processing makes the biojet fuel nearly indistinguishable from petroleum jet fuel. It doesn't matter whether refiners start with beef fat, leftover cooking oil, or a plant like camelina. Camelina is promising because it can be grown on fallow wheat fields and doesn't displace food crops. Braun says there are lots of reasons going to biofuel makes sense for the Pentagon.
Economically, it could be a real cost saver. Strategically, it would guarantee supplies for our aircraft. And then environmentally, I mean, that just goes without saying.
Studies show fuel made from camelina can reduce greenhouse gas emissions by more than 80%. The Air Force hopes to get half the fuel it uses for domestic flights from alternative sources by 2016. But the small batches of biofuel made so far cost about 10 times more than traditional fuel. Braun says that's a hurdle for Pentagon officials.
They're committed as long as they can get these fuels at cost-competitive pricing. So that means that industry is going to have to step up their production and start creating much larger quantities of fuel.
Well, that's a classic chicken and the egg problem.
Tom Todaro is the CEO of Alt Air, one of the companies that's turning camelina into jet fuel.
To build a refinery at scale is hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. If you don't have known customers, you will not ever build that facility.
Todaro says larger plants will produce cheaper fuel.
We've demonstrated this works. We're going to demonstrate very, very quickly that it's surprisingly affordable.
The military isn't the only potential big customer. Airlines want biofuel, too. But Sharon Pinkerton from the Air Transport Association says the airlines aren't in financial shape to back a new industry.
We can't get there by ourselves.
The federal government is stepping in. It's giving incentives to farmers to start growing camelina. And the departments of Navy, Energy, and Agriculture are planning to invest $500 million in biofuel refineries.
To flip the line from Field of Dreams, if the Navy comes, they will build it.
Navy Secretary Ray Mabus says he's often asked why he's such a big fan of biofuels.
The answer is pretty straightforward. We buy too much fossil fuels from potentially or actually volatile places on Earth.
Mabus says this leaves the U.S. military vulnerable. That's why he's committed to getting half of the Navy's fuel from renewable sources by 2020. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
One of the worst-kept secrets in Silicon Valley was made official today. Former eBay CEO Meg Whitman is taking over at Hewlett-Packard. Making the announcement, the HP board called Whitman a technology visionary with a proven track record of execution. Her predecessor lasted less than a year on the job. Here's NPR's Richard Gonzalez.
With the firing of Leo Apotheker, HP, once one of high-tech's bedrock companies, is letting go of its third CEO in 6 years. The former CEO, Mark Hurd, was forced out a year ago in a squabble over ethics and improper expense reports. Since Hurd's departure, HP's market value has shrunk by $60 billion. Apotheker didn't help things when he announced last month that HP, a name virtually synonymous with quality PCs and printers, might or might not get out of the hardware business and focus on software. Jeffrey Sonnenfeld is a dean at Yale School of Management. He says that announcement confused everyone, customers, suppliers, vendors, employees, and shareholders.
There was a term, the HP way, which you may recall, that was industrial folklore. It had in a good way, there was a certain mythic imagery of what HP stood for in terms of the quality of the product and the kind of a management of the organization. Well, that's all gone. I mean, the HP way, they've lost their way.
And that's a popular view here in California as well. Ashok Kumar, an analyst at Rodman & Renshaw, had even harsher words, calling HP a clown without a circus, a tragicomedy.
It's really unfortunate because you have a company that's iconic of the valley and it's becoming increasingly a laughingstock. And it does damage the morale of the rank-and-file HP employees.
And Kumar says even if you question Apotheker's strategic decisions, he had to be acting with the implicit blessing of the board.
And so to blame the current CEO for some of its woes, it's unfair.
Enter into this saga former eBay CEO Meg Whitman, who is getting her second shot at a second act. She's legendary for having taken over eBay when it had a few dozen employees and $86 million in revenues. Under her leadership, eBay became a household term, earning almost $6 billion in revenue. Then she got the idea to run for governor of California last year.
We can fix California, no question about it. It's going to take a different style of leadership. It's going to take a different approach, but we can make California great again.
Running as a Republican, Whitman spent more than $170 million, almost all of it her own money. That was a record amount for any statewide office in the country. But she lost to an aging former governor, Democrat Jerry Brown, by 13 percentage points. Now, as the new CEO of HP, Whitman will be the second woman to run that company. The first, Carly Fiorina, lost her bid to represent California in the United States Senate last year, too. Yale's Jeffrey Sonnenfeld says Whitman has many qualities that might help her succeed in turning HP around. He says she's entrepreneurial and resilient.
She's got to make strategic sense of this business. She might be able to pull it off. She's a capable communicator. She could have been better in the campaign, but I think she's learned a lot from that process. And she's not an ideologue. She's not Carly Fiorina. I think she has the capability to learn from where her mistakes were, and I think she can do better.
But Sonnenfeld says another challenge for Whitman is doing what her three predecessors failed to do, deal with a board of directors he calls poisonous. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is NPR. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. We begin this hour in Syria. The government there is struggling to put down a six-month-old rebellion by citizens demanding political freedom. Sophisticated web surveillance of anti-government activists has led to arrest. Pro-government hackers use the web to go after the opposition activists and their cause. And it's turned the internet into another battleground. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Beirut.
Syria's embattled government insists there is no uprising in the country and explains the unrest this way on Syrian TV. It's a fabrication, says the announcer, an international plot. A satellite image zooms in on sites outside Syria, where the announcer says replicas of Syrian cities have been built. That's where French, American, and Israeli directors create protest videos, she says, using actors, cinematic tricks flashing on the screen. For those who don't quite buy this heavy-handed propaganda campaign, a cadre of young, tech-savvy Syrians is waging a more sophisticated pro-regime effort, flooding Facebook, news sites, and web pages. They call themselves the Syrian Electronic Army, conducting the most intense cyber warfare in the Arab world, says Gillian York with the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
You know, I've really never seen anything like this before, like the Syrian Electronic Army, which just seems to have so many members. I think it's really just their level of persistence and their level of activity that sets them apart.
Are they part of the regime? That's uncertain, says York. Although Syrian President Bashar al-Assad saluted the youth of the Electronic Army in a June speech when they first emerged.
So it may be that they are supported by the government, and maybe that they are independent pro-government forces.
Either way, this army has created a stir by hacking hundreds of websites, most recently of Newsweek, the U.S. Department of Treasury, actor Brad Pitt, and television personality Oprah Winfrey, to refute reports that Syria's uprising is a demand for political freedom. They blame terrorists for the violence, a message that matches the government's consistent line.
This is something that Iran, I think, has helped Syria with immensely.
That's Josh Landis, an American academic who writes an influential blog on Syria. He says that when the protests began, the government's response was to try to close the country to outside information, banning almost all international media. The Iranians, says Landis, counseled Syria to mount a more sophisticated response.
You've got to train up a cadre of young, hep Syrians who can get on all these social media. And that's what they've tried to do.
Do you think that it's effective or it is simply a nuisance, for example, an attack on Oprah's site?
Well, that sort of attack, you know, I think it's all 10 thumbs. But to have young voices that are sympathetic to the regime, if the Syrians don't do it, if the regime doesn't do it, they're going to lose even their own supporters, because the message is just going to be so one-sided.
The Electronic Army counters the protest demand for change with a message of fear, says Landis.
This is a religious war. This is a sectarian war. They're going to kill the Christians. They're going to kill this. And they try to scare a much wider umbrella of people.
For months, young activists had the upper hand on the web, organizing online, evading a security service that could do little more than monitor all cell phone calls. Now, it appears the regime is catching up, as demonstrated by the hacking skills of the Syrian Electronic Army, says activist Alexander Page, the alias he uses online.
So it's definitely become a much more serious. And I think that people have to understand that. People have to see that the Syrian Electronic Army is capable of getting hold of activists through what they're doing.
The internet has become almost as dangerous as protesting on the streets, as activist Amr Sadek, because after arrest, activists are forced to contact friends.
At the end of the day, you will never know who is actually sitting behind that account and looking at that monitor. The security forces are using his account, are using his identity to know about their moves. That's one of the main risks.
The relentless arrests, compromised protest plans, and activists identified from secure lists on Facebook. It's all a sign of the success of this new campaign.
That was NPR's Deborah Amos in Beirut.
About a year ago, a German cybersecurity expert named Ralph Langner announced that he had found a computer worm designed to sabotage a nuclear facility in Iran. It was called Stuxnet, and it was the most sophisticated worm he had ever seen. In the years since, Stuxnet has been analyzed as a cyber superweapon, one so dangerous it could even harm those who created it. Last week, Ralph Langner sat down with NPR's Tom Gelton to discuss his discovery.
Langner Communications is a little firm in Hamburg, Germany, but Ralph Langner and the two engineers with whom he works know a lot about industrial control systems, and in the summer of 2010, they went to work analyzing a malicious software program that was turning up in some equipment. Someone had dubbed the worm Stuxnet. Langner was flabbergasted.
I'm in this business for 20 years, and what we saw in the lab when analyzing Stuxnet was far beyond everything we had ever imagined.
It was a worm that could burrow its way into an industrial control system, the kind of system used in power plants, refineries, and nuclear stations. Amazingly, it ignored everything it found except the one piece of equipment it was seeking. When the worm reached its target, it would destroy it. Langner was in Washington recently for a cybersecurity conference. In an interview on the sidelines, he told me the more his team analyzed the Stuxnet worm, the more they knew they were onto something big.
We were pretty much working around the clock, because after we had the first impression of the magnitude of this, we were just like on speed or something like that. It was just impossible to go back to sleep.
Was it exciting?
Well, absolutely.
Langner couldn't imagine who could have created it. Each day, he was more impressed.
The first time, well, this is a banger. Wow, that's fantastic. That's huge. And then a couple of days later, the next experience like this, so we were thinking, well, what's coming next? What are these guys, at what level are they? Are they aliens or what?
But that would be science fiction. This was reality.
Thinking about it for another minute, well, if it's not aliens, it got to be the United States.
Another realization. By analyzing the Stuxnet code, Langner concluded it was designed to disable a particular nuclear facility in Iran. That's serious business, he figured. Some Iranian nuclear scientists, he remembered, had been mysteriously killed. But he published his findings anyway.
I wasn't actually scared, but this was just something I was thinking about. And you know, this stuff must involve intelligence services who do some dirty work every now and then. You can't just block that away from your personal situation when you are the guy who is the first to publish, yeah, this is a directed attack against the Iranian nuclear program. So there have been some frightening moments.
The sophistication of the worm, plus the fact that the designer had inside intelligence on the Iranian facility, led Langner to conclude the United States had developed Stuxnet, possibly with the help of Israeli intelligence. Langner isn't shy about naming the U.S. as the Stuxnet culprit. Here he is speaking recently at the Brookings Institution.
I'm absolutely convinced that the United States is the leading force behind Stuxnet.
In that Brookings speech, he also made a bigger point that having developed Stuxnet as a computer weapon, the United States may in effect have introduced it into the world's cyber arsenal.
Cyber weapons proliferate by use, as we see in the case of Stuxnet. Several months or weeks or a year later, the code is available on the internet for dissection by anybody who has the motivation and time to do so.
It would have to be revised, Langner says, in order to target some other industrial control system besides the one in Iran, a U.S. power plant, for example. But it could be done, he said, and U.S. utility companies, he warned, are not yet prepared to deal with the threat Stuxnet represents. The CIA declined comment on Langner's charge that the U.S. was the leading force behind Stuxnet, and Homeland Security officials insist measures are being taken to defend U.S. infrastructure against cyber attack. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. You've likely seen one, probably lots of them by now, those funny-looking little pixelated squares that have been popping up on billboards and in magazine and newspaper ads. They're called QR codes or quick response codes, and you're supposed to scan them with your cell phone camera. As NPR's Sammy Yenigan reports, marketing departments all over the country are coming up with clever ways to use them.
Back in 1994, when barcodes ruled the digital scanning universe, the automotive components company Denso Wave Incorporated came up with a better way to track car parts for Toyota, QR codes. Now, they're more than just axle trackers. At the salad restaurant Sweetgreen in Washington, D.C., there's a huge square on the wall hanging over the napkin dispenser.
It looks like some arcade game from the 80s.
James Mitchell's waiting for his salad. He has a smartphone, but doesn't know that he can use it to scan the pixelated code next to him. Neither does Rachel McLaughlin.
It kind of looks like a television that's out of order.
What Sweetgreen wants McLaughlin to do is whip out her phone and take a picture of the broken television arcade game thing. Elizabeth Burks knows what I'm talking about.
It's like one of those scanner things where you just scan it and it tells you whatever information is behind it.
A smartphone app will interpret the picture and link the phone to a website. Sweetgreen was an early adopter of QR.
We would use them in stores and you snap a picture of the code and then the link directs you to some sort of website. It could be a ticket to something. It could be a coupon.
McKee Floyd is director of brand development for Sweetgreen. But Floyd is a QR skeptic. She says it takes too long to unlock your phone, fire up the app, take the picture, and wait for the page to load.
The issue that I have with QR codes is that, you know, marketing is a little bit like telling a joke. And the longer the joke, the better the punchline has to be. And QR code is a really long joke.
According to a recent study from digital analyst ComScore, a measly 6% of mobile subscribers currently use the technology. That 6% tends to be male, white, and wealthy.
That's partly why there hasn't been a massive uptake, although that's changing as the smartphone market starts to expand.
Oliver Williams, founder of the online marketing agency Oliver Digital, says they're used for digital treasure hunts, for grocery shopping. They're on cupcakes, coasters, and in catalogs. In Japan, where smartphones are more widely used,
there are people that are actually having QR codes put on their tombstones, so that when you go to scan them, you can see a photo of the person that died.
Now, there's something on the horizon that both Williams and Floyd say could replace QR codes, and that's near-field communication, or NFC. This is being used for something QR isn't, paying for things. So instead of using a credit card to pay for your salad, you can just tap your phone to a plate by the register.
With near-field communication, you're dealing with transactions that people can profit from, and so the banks have got an interest because they take a percentage.
Last week, Google launched their first near-field communication app, Google Wallet. It seems that by the time people finally figure out what QR codes are good for, they might just be swiping past them at the checkout line. Sammy Yenigan, NPR News.
In New York City, cell phone service is finally going underground. Transit officials today launched wireless service at 6 subway stations in Manhattan. Many New Yorkers welcomed the long-delayed project as a step forward. But as NPR's Joel Rose reports, others aren't so sure.
There were already a few spots above ground where subway riders could catch a decent wireless signal, including the Manhattan and Williamsburg bridges. But the underground station at 8th Avenue and 14th Street in Chelsea was not one of them. So the new service today left many riders there pleasantly surprised.
Definitely is a good idea. Matter of fact, it's not a good idea. That's an understatement. It's a great idea. I'm a Facebook junkie. I'm a YouTube junkie. I need to have coverage everywhere I go.
It's kind of convenient because I'm running late for an appointment, so I was able to call them and let them know that I might be a little bit late because the train seems to not be coming.
It's perfect signal, yeah. That's great. It's a progress. It's the future.
Franklin Greenaway, Tammy Ramsey, and Max Galota were waiting on the Uptown ACE platform. Elsewhere in the station, transit officials were holding a press conference to announce the new wireless service in 6 subway stations. Carmen Bianco is a senior vice president at the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which runs the subway.
Our customers are now, they have one more opportunity to use the technology to stay in touch.
That is, only if they're also customers of AT&T or T-Mobile. So far, they're the only wireless companies to sign on with the new underground network, a project expected to cost up to $200 million. Bianco and other officials also stressed the safety advantages of having wireless service on subway platforms. William Bain is the CEO of Transit Wireless, the company that's building the underground network.
The NYPD's view, as is our view, is that it actually enhances security capability by connecting people. They're aware, they see something, they say something. Right now, there's no way to communicate outside the underground. So, you know, the view is that this enhances security.
But not everyone is excited about the new service. Daniel Moreno says the subway system is one of the last places in the city that you can escape from the constant barrage of emails and text messages and other people's cell phone conversations.
It's totally annoying. Yes, absolutely. It's bad enough. Like, no one has decorum about talking on the phone, walking down the stairs, you know, wait till you get to work.
Even Andrew Albert, chair of the New York City Transit Riders Council, concedes that underground cell phone service is a mixed blessing. On the plus side, Albert says it will let riders get real-time updates from the MTA about train service without having to leave the station. But Albert can see the argument against it, too.
The subway was sort of your last refuge from the idle chatter of, did you see what so-and-so was wearing, and what did they serve, and, you know, dear, I'll be home soon, and all of that kind of stuff. Of course, you still have the option to keep your phone off, right? You don't have to turn it on.
Yeah, right.
MTA officials plan to expand wireless service to another 30 stations in Manhattan within a year. They hope to have wireless access in all 277 stations by 2015. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR.